Howdy, folks. Welcome to Drive the Bid on Auto Hunter. I'm Diego Rosenberg, and I'm with Derek Shakey once again.
Hello.
That was a nice hello. So, shall we begin?
Yes.
Okay, we are going to start with news, folks, and this is yours.
Okay, so a lot of people lament the fact that, manual transmission cars are few and far between these days, and that is true. Not as many as there used to be, obviously, but there is some good news. So there have been some companies have run the numbers, and apparently over the past 2 or 3 years, there's been an uptick in manual transmission car sales. So J.D. Power said so far, 1.7% of new vehicle sales this year have been manual transmission. Small number, but it's almost twice the percentage of what was sold in 2021. And CarMax has run the numbers as well. So in 2020, 2.4% of what they sold were manual transmission cars. The next year, that went up to 2.8 and 2.9 in 2022. So jury's still out on the entirety of 2023, but it is a positive trend. Now, oddly enough, 20-something buyers are behind a lot of these purchases, at least with CarMax. And there's a variety of reasons for that. So there's the throwback nature of manual transmissions. There's nostalgia. And then there's parents who want to keep their kid drivers focused on the road so that they're not texting. Since you need two hands to drive and shift, you know, that keeps them from sending tweets and all that kind of stuff.
As a stick shift owner, I agree. I approve.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great, we were talking with our cameraman, Dustin, earlier. I mean, it's a great skill to have. I mean, even if once you learn it, if you don't need to use it anytime soon, I mean, you'll always have it, you know, and if you need to help somebody out, or if you have a rental car, or you want to rent like a, you know, high powered sports car, it's good to be able to drive stick.
So is there significance to these pictures at all? They're just stick shifts.
These are most of these pictures, except for the Bugatti EB110. These are shameless Auto Hunter picture plugs. These cars, given their age, obviously are not on the list of the top sellers. Oddly enough, the number one seller, at least with CarMax, as far as manual transmission cars, is the Honda Civic. Now, obviously, they offer performance versions of that, and that's followed by the Mustang, the WRX, and then the Wrangler, Camaro, and so on and so on. An interesting tidbit from the Ward's Auto article, there was an industry professional who, you know, has like 40 years experience in automotive retail. And he said one of the reasons that there's been a decline in manual transmission car sales is automakers are not fond of all of the warranty repairs that have to be performed, because people get a manual car, they don't know how to drive it, they grind the gears, they burn the clutch, and then they take it in. Which, you know, that was something I never thought about before, because I always knew, like, you know, it's a take rate thing. It's a dying, you know, transmission form. But I never thought about that end of it. I can see why, you know, manufacturers would be at least reluctant to keep offering them.
Well, I, for one, am glad. But I don't know. I just I'm not hopeful. Especially as we evolve into more EVs and if not dual clutch automatics, whatever you want to call them, sequential, blah, 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 Formula One stuff, you know?
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, it used to be that if you, 20 something years ago, because automatics have come a long way, especially the dual clutch versions, it used to be that if you got a manual transmission, first of all, you were saving money because it was cheaper. And then you got better fuel economy, and then even emissions used to be better. But now modern automatics have done away with all those advantages. So now it's kind of like, you know, when there was the quartz crisis in the Swiss watch industry, you know, a quartz watch is more accurate. It's, you know, more robust. It's not as delicate. It's not as expensive. But people continued buying automatic Swiss watches because it was for the luxury, for the craftsmanship. And I think it's a similar thing with auto, with manuals. You know, you have that engagement, you have that kind of comparatively old world interaction, and then it's more special, you know, because anybody can just drive an automatic.
Very good. So my news is this car. It is a Mercedes 580 S580E. So that is a hybrid version, I guess a plug-in hybrid version of the Mercedes S-Class. Now, I have no interest in this car in the least, but this car, according to Car and Driver, has gone 58 miles all on electricity. So Car and Driver does, they test all their cars on the battery alone. Let's say at a fixed speed with cruise control, with a climate control system, and I think they said 72 degrees, just some kind of baseline so everything's consistent among all the cars that they test. And this one did 58 miles, which was, I believe, 14 miles per gallon, or let's say 14 miles longer or further than what Mercedes claims. And it was also, maybe it was 12 and 14 more than the second place finisher in their tests in the past, which was a Volvo. In any case, this is a car that goes 0 to 60 in 4.2 seconds. This Car and Driver tested this car at 36 highway miles per gallon, but it also weighs 5,600 pounds. So, I mean, kudos to Mercedes for creating a vehicle that kind of does it all except for the weight, but it's also pretty pricey as well. The aerodynamics for this car is 0.22.
Wow.
Drag coefficient. The all-electric car is 0.20. And this car looks so much better.
It does.
So, you know, I just thought it was interesting. That's all. Just because, you know, the industry is moving in that direction, for better or worse.
Yeah, and it just makes me wonder, how giant that battery pack is. I mean, obviously, it's got a long wheelbase, so they've got plenty of room. Well, but to get that kind of electric range is impressive.
They said that the battery pack was a lot bigger than the next biggest one that they've tested in a Volvo. Okay. So the battery pack is the key in this case.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
So, Steve Mignante update. There is no update right now other than last week he had sat up in bed and he is stable right now. So, you know, when we know more, when there's more posts on YouTube, we will be sure to give you the news. In the meantime, as I work, I always have one of his videos rolling in the background just to help him monetize his business while he recuperates. So,
this is one of those situations in which no news is good news.
Yes. So next, we're going to do a feature, at least for today. It's kind of like Today I Learned. So Derek is going to tell me about something that he's into. I'm totally in the dark about this other than the pictures that are in the PowerPoint presentation. So in this case, Derek is going to teach me a little bit about the Bugatti.
Yeah, so the Bugatti Veyron is what I would call a numbers car. You know, it's a million-dollar plus car, 1,001 horsepower, 8-liter, 16-cylinder, quad turbo, dual clutch, all sorts of numbers. And then, as you can see here on the window sticker for this particular one, almost $1.8 million. City MPG, that's a small number, one of the few small numbers associated with this car. 8 City MPG. And then there's another one after this. I mean, you get the idea of another window sticker. But there's some other numbers that are just as staggering about the Veyron. So a few years ago, an outlet covered this video shot by the owner of two Veyrons. So they have, he's a real estate investor and a social media personality. I'm hoping I should be able to get this right. Manny Hoshbin. And so he has a couple of them, including an Hermes edition. And so he kept track of all of the repair costs and maintenance costs for his car. So According to the outlet, a base Veyron at that time, I think this was like 2019, was $1.7 million. He had a Legend Series Roadster that cost over $3 million. So he returned the figures. A fluids change, and keep in mind there are 16 drain plugs on a Veyron. Fluids change, $25,000. That is the perfect reaction. And it gets much better. So Bugatti recommends changing the tires every 2 to 3 years. Doing that, just the tires alone, since these are specially made tires for a car that can do over 250 miles an hour, costs $38,000 a set. And keep in mind, that was like 4 or 5 years ago. So probably gone up considerably since then. And unlike basically every other car I've ever heard of, Bugatti also recommends every 10,000 miles changing the wheels. And doing that costs $50,000. And so this outlet, The Drive, they crunched some numbers too. And they calculated that putting 10,000 miles on the car every 2 years would cost $113,000 over 24 months.
Is there such thing as a Bugatti cheapskate?
No. Well, I mean, I guess if you made a kit car, you could call it that.
Well, I was just thinking maybe someone's like, 10,000 miles, I'm going to go 20.
Probably. Yeah. I mean, it's not unheard of for certain wealthy people to be frugal. So, as I said earlier, this has four turbos. According to The Drive, Manny, replacing one of the turbos costs $6,400. If you do two at the same time, the labor back then was $9,000 to do two at once. Now, camshafts are different because of all of the complexity of getting to it and all the, you know, all of the mechanics around it just to get to the part. A camshaft, $800, but the labor to change one, guess how much that would be?
$25,000.
Close. $21,000. And they said the fuel tank is the priciest, at least of the parts that Manny covered. So if for whatever reason the fuel tank needed to be replaced, obviously there's a lot of stuff to get out of the way. Just changing the fuel tank would be $42,000.
Why would you need to change the fuel tank?
That's what I was wondering, but that was one of the mind-blowing dollar amounts that I saw. So I had to include that in this, but I don't know. I'm thinking, okay, maybe you ever see every now and then there'll be a news site that comes across like a collection of exotic cars abandoned at an airport or whatever, you know, or like in the UAE or whatever. Maybe somebody lets it sit out for months, fuel goes bad, whatever. But that amount, almost half of it, 22 grand, is just the labor to do the job. Yeah. So this reminds me, I think I watched a video several years ago. Somebody was talking about what it costs to, you know, maintain a McLaren F1. And I remember them saying I remember them saying it's all telephone numbers. Same thing here.
Yeah, that's nuts.
I remember there was a story I read several years ago that there's a guy who owned one of these, and it was something like if he wanted to do a road trip in it, it was cheaper for him to like fly in his private jet to a place and have his car already there instead of driving the Veyron itself. Something like that. Yeah.
That's depressing. Okay. So what am I going to do for you? We're going to talk about the first muscle car. Now, do you know what the first muscle car is according to you?
To me?
Yeah, you must have an opinion, maybe.
Gosh, you know, I never thought about it in those terms.
Okay.
BMW Isetta.
Muscle car?
Yeah, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, okay. So I'm one of the people who thinks it's a 1964 Pontiac GTO. Not everyone agrees. I am open to disagreements. Everyone has a different opinion, and that's okay. But I think that there are some good reasons to think that the GTO was the first muscle car. So a lot of people think that the Chrysler 300 from 1965, technically it's called a C300, first car to have 300 horsepower, but also it was weighed over 4,000 pounds. It was pretty expensive. It was, you know, it was for the well-heeled.
Yeah.
And I don't really think that a muscle car is for the rich. Muscle cars are not determined by dentists, you know? So the idea of having a special performance model, I think, is key to the first muscle car. And the Chrysler has it, but I think it's just, it's too early and it's too expensive and it's not fast enough. 300 horsepower back then was great, but I mean, how fast is it in the quarter mile? Probably mid 16s at best. I don't know. That's not muscle car material. Some people like to go to the Rocket 88. This is a 1949 Oldsmobile 88. They call the engine the Rocket. There is no model called a Rocket 88. Actually, the series is an 80. And if it had a six-cylinder, it was an 86. And if it had an eight-cylinder, it was an 88. That's where the name comes from.
Easy enough.
Yeah. So this is one of the first high-compression motors after World War II. Cadillac had the other one in 1949. And, okay, so the Olds 88 is more egalitarian. It's more populist, let's say. Everyone can afford it for the most part. But this is not a muscle car. It's just a high compression engine and a relatively light body. That's fair, but it's not fast, at least in the terms of muscle cars. I mean, this is, I'm going to guess, an 18-second car. Some people even go back to 1936 with the introduction of the Buick Century because they put the Roadmaster engine in the smaller wheelbase of the Century.
Okay.
Actually, let's say it's the Roadmaster engine in the Buick Special, and they called it the Century. That may be a more accurate way of saying it. You know, they called it a Century because it could reach, maybe reach 100 miles per hour, cruise 100 miles per hour. I'm not really sure. Something impressive for its time, but that's not a muscle car. And does this look like a muscle car to you?
Not okay. Quite.
So some people also like to think the Rambler Rebel from 1957 was a muscle car. At least the first. I mean, the way I see it, if you have a 300 came before this. This supposedly is the second fastest car from 1957 behind the fuel-injected Corvette, but also the fast Rebel that they tested was a fuel-injected car, and that ended up not making production. If it did make it to production, they replaced it with carburetors.
Mm.
So it's a little bit unfair to say it's the second fastest car, but either way, they're all four doors also. I'm not averse to a four-door muscle car. Let's say like have a Hemi Coronet with four doors. That's cool, but this does not reek muscle car to me. So the Mopar people, if it's not the 300, they say, okay, in 1962, the Dodge and Plymouth Twins, in this case, this is a Plymouth Savoy from 1962. Chrysler downsized these cars a little bit based on a rumor that GM was going to downsize its cars. That didn't really happen. It actually may have been a confusion with the Nova coming out. I don't really know. Whatever the case may be, these are a little bit smaller than your full-size car at the time. Let's compare the GTO. The wheelbase of the GTO is 115 inches, and this is 116. Their lengths are about the same. And this car has a max wedge 413. This is the Dodge version, the Dodge Dart, before the Dart became a compact. Goofy styling, you know, accepting the goofy styling, I don't really see these cars any different than, let's say, a Pontiac Super Duty Catalina. Sure, the Mopars are a little bit smaller, you know, in wheelbase and length, but in the end, they were still full-size cars, and the max wedge was a racing engine for the drag strip, just like the Super Duty 421 was for the Catalina. So I don't really think that the Mopars are the first muscle cars. Never mind the fact that the template that we usually go by, like a mid-size car, that was kind of created by the GTO. So it's almost like you're getting the GTO and saying, well, okay, there's some Mopars that had a similar proportions at the earlier. No, that's kind of like, there's a term for this. I don't remember, but you know, you get something from the future and apply it to something previously. And it's like, no, you can't have that.
Anachronistic.
I mean, yeah, sure. I mean, it may be anachronistic. That's a word I remember. Maybe I just wasn't, finding it, but yeah, that may be it. I was going to talk about the Ford Fairlane, but I forgot about the, I forgot to have the slide. But the Ford Fairlane is usually considered the first mid-size car. They came out in 1962. So here we have the old score 4.2. This is pretty much the first answer to the GTO. Came out mid-year 1964. Didn't compare to the GTO, but in 65 it had a bigger engine and maybe was more of a proper competitor. In 1965, Buick came out with the Grand Sport. 1966, Chevy had the Super Sport, which was basically the Malibu Super Sport. It was just a buckets and console type of car. But mid-year, they came out with the 396. The order code was Z16. But they only made 201 of those. So in some ways, really, Chevrolet's proper introduction to the muscle car sweepstakes was the 1966 SS396. In 1966, Ford came out with the Fairlane GT and Mercury Cyclone GT. So what cars introduced all these copycats? It was the GTO. It was not some Max Wedge, Plymouth, or Dodge. So that is my case in favor of the GTO being the first muscle car. Another way to explain it is that you had all these cars with these racing engines, like the Max Wedge and the Super Duty. When GM decided to get out of racing around January 1963, it was difficult for Pontiac because Pontiac invested a lot of their image on racing and performance. If they can't have racing and have the public see what kind of performance their cars demonstrate, and then, you know, they go to the dealership and get influenced by that image, what can Pontiac do? Well, Pontiac brought performance to the street, and that's where the GTO came in. So lastly, sometimes you get people who say that pony cars like the Camaro can't be muscle cars. I disagree. I actually, forgive me, I think it's pretty idiotic, that argument. Think of it this way. A pony car is a class of car, right? It's a two-door coupe or convertible, long hood, short deck, generally based on a compact. In the Camaro's case, it was shared things with the Nova. The Mustang shared things with the Falcon. So you have this pony car. Another class of car is a midsize intermediate. Let's say you get a Le Mans, put a big engine, it becomes a GTO. So it's all the same thing. You can have a pony car with a big engine like this 427 Camaro. It's a muscle car. The people who say a car like this is not a muscle car, I don't really understand where they're coming from. It makes no sense. That's my piece.
I didn't see you step off your soapbox there.
No, I don't need to.
That's some fancy footwork.
So next, we have some Auto Hunter cars, right? This is your pick.
Yeah. So I think part of my picking this comes from the fact that I've always loved that Nicolas Cage movie, The Rock. They had an F-355 in it, a yellow one. If I remember correctly, a lot of people said that was a kit car, possibly based on a Pontiac Fiero, but I haven't looked into that. But anyway, my Auto Hunter pick for this week is a 97 F-355 Spider, and this is just such a great combination. It's red over tan. It's obviously Spider's convertible top. The GTS models, I think, are even cooler because they have the target top. But inside, you know, no F1 gearbox or anything like that. It's the traditional gated 6-speed manual. This one, the auction for this closes on Friday, September 29th. So more about this. This is relatively low miles, 24,000 and change. And according to the seller, they've put more than $37,000 into it in terms of upgrades. And within the last 5,000 miles, they had an engine out service done. So part of that, the drive belts, tensioners, filters, and even the clutch were replaced. So that's a big one. You know, that's definitely, I think some of these cars can fall in between, you know, can fall into the gaps of deferred maintenance. So it's good to know that this has had an engine out service. That's a big one. This is also fitted with a Capristo exhaust, and it has a key fob that allows you to change the tone of the exhaust. So yeah, just a great looking combination, a modern classic. I mean, I've always liked the 348s that came before these, and they had a, you know, pretty much a similar shape, wedge shaped, but that had the hangover of the side strakes. Whereas this, it has, you know, the big, you know, open inlets. And I think a sexier evolution of the 348 shape, but right before the curves of the 360.
So would you say this is a heavily facelifted and re-engineered 308? Is there a lineage?
I imagine there is. I could believe it. I mean, you know, you look at coming from the 348. So, and it seems like, you know, I know with just in terms of, like, I think of like Lamborghini V12s, you know, those, the same basic architecture in a lot of cases would filter through into successive generations. But I don't know enough about the 308 to, you know, break that down. But yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of similarities or, you know, significant updates.
Mm-hmm. And the one after this, I think, was all new, right?
The 360?
Yeah.
I don't know. I could believe it if there was some updating there as well. I mean, obviously very different shape and design language, and a larger, yeah, I guess, what? So this was 3.5 liter and the 360 was a 3.6, so you know, it wasn't a radical departure. But yeah, the specifics of that, I don't know. I just know that this one has got a lot to like about it.
The 360 was a 3.6?
Yeah, I think so.
Because I thought the way they number has to do with, like, the size of the piston or something like that.
That was a convention of theirs up until a certain point. There was, I forget which car changed that. Maybe it changed with this one. But yeah, there was a point in time which they did that, and then at some point they just completely changed it.
Okay, very good. So my choice in Auto Hunter is this 1966 Olds 442. This one's kind of interesting because it has some modifications that it looks pretty stock, but it has some modifications. One of them is the color, both inside and outside. I believe this color is called Autumn Bronze. I'm not really sure. That's the 400 big block that was available that year, 350 horsepower. That's the rear end. Now, this one's a Cutlass 442 because it was an option available on certain Cutlass and F85 models. If you didn't have, let's say, the side trim, that would be an F85. And, of course, more basic interior. Probably no buckets available. I'm not really sure. Maybe because there was an F85 and an F85 Deluxe that were available with the 442 package. Maybe the F85 Deluxe could get buckets. I don't know. Anyway, the interesting thing about this car is the accessory codes. So in, let's say, the fifth column, so 5VY, that just means, let's say, series 5. So taken unto themselves, it's 5V and 5Y. 5V is your hint that this is a 442 because it's an option, you can't tell from the VIN. This is a Cutlass VIN. But 5V tells you in 1966 it's a 442. So that is our Auto Hunter for today. Thank you very much, Derek, for teaching me about Bugattis and even some Ferraris and updating me on the second life that manual transmissions may be having.
Yeah. I mean, they're in some way, you know, they're sticking around a little longer. Let's hope that trend continues on that path.
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you very much for listening or viewing our podcast at Drive the Bid on Auto Hunter. We will see you next week. Thank you very much.
Goodbye.